mental health and domestic violence and the legal system, nonprofit organization, hospital to come and see if we can begin to discuss how does culture and systems in this country, and are there any difference in terms of how they formulate their premises to their legal thinking or their way of help-seeking behavior and how they conceptualize programs, and see if down the line we can begin to foster some systems change as a way to be more encompassing of the thinking of the new refugees. So these were some of the guidelines that help us to put the program together. So we began the violence and suicide prevention with some sort of a roadmap that touched on three components. One is to look at the way we have disseminated information, well, created and disseminated information. We know that historically, professionals have developed videos and flyers and used traditional means of sending those or disseminating those through the mails or through different clinics. And we know that it has not been very effective, in particular with the Hmong community, because they don't go borrow the videos to view. They had the flyer, but a lot of them are not, they're illiterate, so they can't read. And so we know that the dissemination of information has been poor. It has been ineffective. So we need to find a different mechanisms to engage the Hmong community. Again, we know that the provider community has been working very hard in the last 20 years, but in our way of thinking, have been working more from a translated mode. And one of the things that we struggled with in the last 20 years because of time, the Hmong as a community has not had the opportunity to develop professional resources. But we know that the time has got to a point where there are a lot of Hmong professionals who can begin to do some of the work. So we can combine the cultural knowledge as well as some of the training so that I think the work can be more in-depth. Then we want to encourage, again, the systems, excuse me, coming together to look at how can we encourage some changes. So those were the kind of the roadmap. In our way of understanding the Hmong community, the next slide, we know that in our work and in my many consultation role with agencies serving Hmong, I asked, why do you call? I have an example of, I did a consultation for, a year-long consultation for an agency in town where they provided, there are both Hmong and non-Hmong worker in the agency, and they give cases to both Hmong and non-Hmong worker as a way to encourage diversity with the staff. What happened with the Hmong case is that the Hmong client were calling only the Hmong worker who were not on the primary role but were assigned to work as interpreter and not calling the American primary workers. So they developed a lot of resentment among the staff because the Hmong worker were very overwhelmed with many, many cases, though they were not part of their cases, and the American were feeling they are not having any case because the Hmong client were not calling them but calling the interpreter. So there were a lot of resentment between that, and the workplace was very low, so I got a year-long contract to do a consultation. Went out and talked to the Hmong client, and they say that, well, we don't call our American primary care workers because every time they come to visit us, it's purely about information about work. Pull out the chart and say, I need all this information. So we feel that the relationship is not humanizing. We almost feel like it's a process where they come to get some information. Whereas the Hmong worker will come and they know the whole me. They know the me that needs help. They know the me that beyond the needing help, what I do in the community, what my daily job life is like, where do we hang out. So I feel more holistic with these people. So in our way of thinking, we want to make sure that when we work with the Hmong community, we understand the women who may have never had education. How do we get the suicide message, and how do we include their way of thinking, whether it's about protective variables or whatever their way of thinking is. How do we include that versus it maybe among physicians' point of view of what is our effect that they've been contributing to violence and suicide in the communities and all of that. So the slide, I say, which one of me do you really know? Is we want to make sure that we're not so looking at the stuff that are important to American way of life and looking at that. And sometimes we completely miss the Hmong side, the side that keeps the relationship human. And in my experience doing therapy, I've been trained to work in the mainstream community a long time before I came back to the Hmong community, and having to learn to understand different lingos and jargons and expressions that might have clinical significance in terms of doing mental status or any other thing to Hmong. And so we want to make sure that we understand the whole community, the whole person, not just the pieces, seems relevant to us. We know that the Hmong community, although it is very young in Minnesota, the 2004 census reflect that about 80% of Hmong are between the age of 18 and 35. And so Hmong's community is very young, but because we're a new refugee community, there are certain sectors in the community that are still very much in control. And so we want to make sure that we break down the community to, we want to understand what are the Hmong who are Asian-born, who are raised in Asian, like my mom and my dad. How are their view of life in America, and what are they thinking that are contributing to suicide and violence, and how do we begin to do some work with that to get the issue out? How do we help them? Versus those who are born in Asian, but like myself, who are raised there, and half of our life is there and half of our life is here. How are our values and our sense of the world is different, versus those who are like my, a few other community leaders. Like, for example, we have a Minnesota senator here who was born in Asian, but who was practically raised here because she came when she was only 3 or 4. Versus like children like my son, or my daughter, who are American born or American raised, but maybe of Hmong heritage, but have nothing to do or want to do nothing to do with Hmong yet at this point. And how do we then begin to understand their thinking? And how do we begin to develop a program or messages that they may be receptive to them? So we have these in mind to, again, understand. We also know that from a health standpoint, Hmong are refugees. And refugees are unlike immigrants. Refugees are people who come because of abrupt circumstance. So their body comes here and slowly then their mind integrate to it. And oftentimes in my cross-cultural consultation, I say to people say, why are these people so hard to work with? I often say, well, these are refugees, whether they're Hmong or they're Somalian, or they may be acting and thinking and behaving like they're in the old days, but they're here. One of the most frequently common made in Minnesota to me is, it is 20 below in Minnesota, and there's a major street in Minnesota in St. Paul called University Avenue. And Hmong are walking on a sidewalk with these sandals and thin blouse. And my colleague will say, you know, aren't they cold? And don't they get it? And I said, of course they get it. They're not stupid, but if that's what you mean, but what they're behaving is reflecting these are refugees who are here. As long as their clothes are clean, their clothes are nice, their minds are not in tune to be in trendy. They're not in tune to be into the weather. And I remember I had a picture taken of me in 1976 when I arrived in Providence, taken in Roger Williams Park in front of a Lincoln statue. I had a nice fur coat on, but the coat, when I look back nowadays, is a woman's fur coat. Both me and my brother had two wonderful youth woman's fur coat, and we didn't care whether it was man or woman. It was nice and warm to us, so it was in a survival mode. And so we want to make sure that whatever the program and whatever the message that we design, that we understand the mindset of these individuals in the community, that we are progressing. We are progressing with time. Those of us who have been here since the 1976 may be thinking and living and value things that are very different from the new refugee who may just arrive from Tankerbog, the new way of refugee who just came from the Buddhist temple in Thailand. And the Hmong who first came are the one who have been soldiers and may have a lot of exposure to American culture versus those who may be coming way later, and those that may live in the jungle and suffer quite a traumatic life experience. So we want to make sure that we understand these thinking. We know that Hmong are like any other refugee. We continue to live life in limbo because we are living and acting like life the way that we know of, that we used to know. And we're having a hard time understanding American life. Although many of us have been here almost 30 years, we still don't understand a lot of things. So life continues to be limbo to us. And this is one of the hypotheses that I have, that I think a lot of the Hmong, the group who have the most horrific crime, that wave of murder-suicide, are those that fall into this group where they feel kind of confident. There's a sense of false confidence of detaching themselves from traditional way of doing things with the elders and the community, and yet they're not fully comfortable with the American way of life, whether it's the legal system, the social service system, or any other system. So they're highly detached from both cultures. And when you give the issue like, oh, privacy, and now their lives are very busy, we all go our own ways, where before, we all go to the farm, we interact with everybody every day, life has much more of an intimate interaction, where nowadays we are much more on our own. We go to work all day long, we come back and barely have time to be with our family. Whereas before, we work interactively with everybody every day, so we almost know everybody, the house are not as well insulated, so if couples are arguing, the next door neighbor will hear about it. So life tends to be more and a much more intimate, where now life becomes very, very private. And so this is a good one of my hypotheses, that is an emergence of the psychological being of living, being Hmong living in America, is that you slowly adjust to the weather, the house, the street, the car, the technology, but psychologically you're beginning to, your sense of self-identity become, what is it? Like being Hmong here, you don't fully understand the support system nowadays, and then you continually to distance yourself from those. So life continues to be limbo. So how do we, again, continue to understand the old world, the existing structure, and how do we then integrate the new system that are in place here with them? And one of the things that are very neatly done, which I think is very unique in Minnesota, is that the legal system, the in Minnesota has agreed with an organization in Minnesota called the 18 Clan Council. Now, Hmong, there are 18 last names in the Hmong society, so each clan, each last name is represented at this council, and they're called the 18 Clan because there are 18 last names in the Hmong society. And in many of the cases that are involved, legal cases that go to this county, legal system, if they have something to do with culture, such as marriage dispute or divorce, and if they're not severe, they're not violent, they're manageable, then the county will kick them back to this 18 Clan Council entity, and they will do mediation. And so how do we begin to engage these systems and integrate what we do? And one of the things we proposed to the 18 Clan Council was to bring in a clinical psychologist, myself, and another Hmong social worker to go in and perhaps offer intensive training about suicide and signs of violence and all these to this team that does all these mediation, because they have the skill to do mediation, they have the respect from the community, they have the members of the community that constantly come and they see all of the issues before it gets to the mainstream community, to me or to the other healthcare providers. How do we integrate these worlds? Unfortunately, we were not taken on that proposal, but we're continuing to try to do these things as a way to integrate what is in existing with the Hmong community and the new stuff. How do we expand the Hmong community sense of getting help? So if you look at the Hmong community, like other refugees, in a very short period of time, Hmong has gone through so much changes. If you look at the matter of 1975, Hmong live in Laos, and we're very isolated up in the mountains of Laos. Our life, daily lives are simple. We learn farming skills. We learn a lot of cultural skills for funerals, for weddings, for healings, and all of those. And our lives are very secluded, and we don't have much contact with the world. And in a matter of 25, 30 years, we go from agrarian society to information. Everything's about fax and email now. And a lot of people don't think about it, but I think it's a lot of transformation in a very short period of time. And a lot of times we can cheat time, but I think there are a lot of times that we cannot cheat time. We just don't talk about it. And so in many ways, when I do therapy, I see people come in, and I think there are a lot of stuff that are going on that just doesn't make sense. And when you put the culture shock, in particular with the adult community, many, many other veterans who come to see me for therapy often said to me that, you know, since I come to America, I feel like I've become much more dumb than I was in, when I was in Laos. And my response to them is, how so? I mean, in the early days, you don't see the world like you see in America, so you're much more knowledge, you're much more exposed to so many things that we have never been exposed to in Laos. How could you be more dumb? Well, what they say is that, well, in Laos, if I have a few ideas, I can at least turn those ideas into some life, some creative thinking way of to make a life for me. In this country, the more I have thoughts, the more I feel stupid because I don't know what the root is. I don't know what is the norm and how to turn these thoughts into some meaningful way of life. So in some way, I think what they talk about their sense of culture shock, that their old behavior are not getting the custom respond or their realization that they no longer know the rule of the game. Whatever they thought was the rule was never the rule. In the early days when Hmong first came to America, there were a number of cases where there are four ways that Hmong, for example, would get married. One of the ways is through engage. An engaged marriage happened between close relatives as a way of, in their own thinking, keeping the gene pool within, so you don't let that go. So you marry someone who is related to you. You engage their daughter to their daughters as a way to maintain the genetic pool. Then you have the people who fall in love and elope. And then you have people who practically, we like your family, so we're going to bring a team of people to come to your house and say, we would like to develop a relationship with you and marry your daughter. And so as a way to develop this connection to you. And the last way we get married in the old day was you go and kind of carry somebody away and make them your wife. So you practically kind of adopt them, abduct them. And so in the early days when Hmong came to America, there were a number of cases that the Hmong young men went to campus, a college, and carried off a girl and was charged with kidnapping and went to jail. And there was a case, I think, I forgot what state, I thought it was in California, and he hung himself because it was shameful for him. What he thought he was doing was getting married. It was called kidnapping here. So I think that there are a lot of people who are doing a lot of stuff. They are essentially detached. They're not sure what the way of life now, and they're not sure if they should be practicing the traditional way of doing things. So life is very detached. Life is in limbo for many more. And one of our continuing goal for the suicide prevention is how to develop some sort of a benchmarking community dialogue, community discussion to find what are the potential different variables that may be contributing to these phenomena. Any question out there so far? I know I talk a lot.
It's terrific so far.
Okay.
It's very interesting.
Okay. And then we want to make sure, again, as I said before, how do we understand Hmong's sense of wellness? Well, Hmong as a group of ethnic group has been people who work in the field. We live up in the mountains a lot. We are agricultural people. So physical functioning is very, very important to us. We're very spiritual people. So we're highly spiritual and we're very physical oriented. And yet one of the things I find is that we're not very psychological mindedness. Psychological and scientific stuff are something that's fairly new to Hmong. And so one of the things that I struggle a great deal is in my prior practice is that Hmong do never come to see me because of psychological issue. They come to see the doctor, and the doctor will do all kinds of diagnostic work, the blood tests, the CAT scan, MRI, and they're okay. And they say, you know, everything is fine. So why don't you go see True, you know? So they always come to me not because they're thinking there's some sort of psychological problem. They always think there's some spiritual. They have always gone through the shaman, the herbalist already. And they go and see their reverence already if they have converted to Christianity, or they've done all kinds of stuff. And then the doctor say, come see me. When they come see me and they say, you're not a doctor who can prescribe meds, and you don't give medicine, and you're not a doctor, what exactly do you do? And I said, well, I talk about stuff. I said, how does talking about it going to help? And so they are very psychological, we're not very psychological minded about our issues. And so we try to understand, is that an issue why Mo are not getting help? If someone is so depressed and they're not getting help and they're equating that to they're waiting until, and typically for me, I normally see cases that are very chronic because they wait and wait and get to a point where they're daily functional are severely impaired and they go to school and they can't study and they can't stay awake because they're drowsy or they can't concentrate. And teachers say, you should go get some help. It's because, again, because how we define wellness. And so we want to make sure that we understand that. We want to understand Mo's way of understanding causes and of illness. In my very limited understanding, I don't mean to, I want to apologize for this if I somehow sounds generalizing, is in many way of my limited understanding of Native American, I felt like Hmong share many similar characteristics. Hmong believe that every natural object in the world has some sort of a super, a guardianship, so you respect the water, you respect the mountain, you respect this and that, and so people can be sick if you don't respect that. You get hurt if you go to the mountain and you get possessed by the guardian of that mountain. Hmong believe that life and death is cyclical, so that if you have done something sinful from your past previous life or you're doing something now, that you will get hurt in the next life. We worship our ancestors, so Hmong believe that if you not fulfilling the obligation that it can be a cause of not being well in the family. Hmong believes that each of us is born with a mandate for life. That there's some sort of like a, you kind of bear the cross like the American way of thinking, and that there are certain that you're destined to encounter certain things, so it's out of your hand, particularly women who come for domestic violence. Have a strong belief in this. And for me, as I'm 40, but I call myself the younger Hmong, I have a hard time trying to take away that kind of belief, saying, I don't know, can you control your mandate, or is it mandate that's kind of fixed? We believe that everybody has to have a soul, other to be stable. The physical entity won't survive without the soul. So in many incidences will cause the soul to depart from the body, and then people will get sick. And then lastly, Hmong do have a bit of understanding, like American, that each of us has some sort of a genetic predisposition that we will be sick and we will be different from other people. And so we're trying to understand how Hmong conceptualize wellness and how they conceptualize causes to wellness or harm. And then what are the traditional remedies for that? Well, historically, Hmong have used a lot of herbal medicine, and herbal medicine has created a lot of complication for both physicians and mental health people in terms of how they take medicine and side effects, and if they're not telling doctors, they're taking other medicines. Hmong practice a lot of spirituality, so shamanism is a form that Hmong continue to practice heavily. Incantation is a form of chanting. It's particularly used for burn or for broken bone or for bleeding. The Hmong use this in the early days of arrival here. Hmong and child protection do not get along because of that. Broken bone, instead of going to the hospital and put a cast on, Hmong go home and have someone do incantation and chanting, put ointment and water on, or Hmong do suction cups, and they get into a lot of trouble with child protection. Soul calling. There are a couple of different ways Hmong do soul calling. When a child is born, on the third morning after the child is born, there will be a soul calling ceremony where the name is given, and that is the time when the name, the body, the person is united with the soul. And for Hmong, a name calling, a name is more than a name. A name represents some sort of a protective aura. So if you know Hmong, you know that there is no Hmong child will be named that will equate to such a word as God. And when there was one incident, I was in Rhode Island. I worked for John Hope Settlement House, which is a African-American agency. Well, it's called African-American Agency, but it serves all kinds of people. And I had a Hispanic client, his name was Jesus, and I told my mom, Mom said, wow, that name's too powerful for that kid. And I said, why? Mom said, well, in Mom, we don't call our kid that powerful because you cannot carry that kind of aura. You can be sick from that. There's a ceremony in the Mom called the string tying in the Laotian. This is a ceremony that is taken from the Laotian culture. In Laotian, it's called Basi, where you tie a lot of string to the wrist as a way of asking for blessings and prosperity and good health. When a child is failing to thrive, one of the things that Hmong will do is they will do a ceremony called bridge ceremony. And the word, I put the word bridge in there. Hmong will actually go and wait at a cross intersection, a road intersection. Whoever first arrives at that intersection, the family who's been waiting there with the child would ask that person to complete the ceremony and add a name to their, a prefix to their name as a way of blessing. And that's why it's called the bridge ceremony. In a critical condition, situation, Hmong will do a praying to do. N-T-U-J is an equivalent to God or to the higher above. Do means the sky for us. But it's a word that is equated to God. So they will pray that. And when Hmong pray in critical condition or when there's a critical situation, Hmong will pray to do and say, if you protect and do this, by certain days and certain time period, if this person is healed or is protected, then we will do this. And some of you may have, particularly in California, have heard about the Hmong and animal sacrifice and how the city and Hmong do not get along because of that. Hmong believe that when you sacrifice animal, then you borrow the life of the animal and substitute for the human life and you fulfill the obligation. There have been many instances where if everything failed, a religious conversion is a way of getting away from evil spirit. And conversion, religious conversion includes both Christianity as well as Buddhism and others. I don't know if those of you who are online know that Hmong as an ethnic group do not practice Buddhism, even though Buddhism is the dominant religion in Laos. And a very, very last resort, there have been Hmong who converted, who has taken on clan conversion, going from one last name to another as a way to abandon bad spirit. The problem with this is that when you have a clan conversion, the political your political future is very, very unlikely because people do not trust it. There's a lot of mistrust in that. And then, as you can see, modern medicine, which me and many of you fall under, are very live in this spectrum of getting help here. And so then they'll come to us and saying, help me, you know. But it's because of the refugee, when Hmong do get help, Hmong are very physical people, physical well-being. So Hmong want something that's tangible. So they come to expect pills. They come and they expect to wanting to know whether their blood are okay, whether they're not feeling well is related to their bone, their vessels, their muscles, all physical stuff. And you say, no, when you're depressed, you're not sleeping well, your body's tense, blah, 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 all these stuff. They say, well, then I want to know what's causing that. Is it because spiritual, which they have done? And how do you go? One, the thing I often joke with my client is that, you know, you go see this Hmong shaman, and they have this huge altar on the wall with all kinds of string attached to the altar running everywhere in the house. Seems very powerful, very mystical. You come to my office with this little 5x7 certificate from the Board of Social Work that I'm certified. Is this scary? And many of them laugh. They kind of laugh and say, isn't that true? And you cure a word. I said, well, I don't know. There's a lot of words that give you perspective to think about. Many Hmong want things to be quick fix. Versus long-term, like depressive, they want things to be cured. They go and they take on pills, and a few days, it doesn't work, and they don't want to do it because they don't believe. They think the doctors are kind of testing them. And so everything they want to be quick fix. They come to me and say, you tell me, you give me all the advice, and I go home and I do it. And I say, well, it's not about advice. It's about how do I help you to look deep inside of you, and you have to have an internal self-reflection process where you think it will make sense that you have to change and wanted to change and take charge like that. And so if you look at that expectation, Hmong refugee whose thinking are not here yet or slowly getting here. they want us to lead, because when in their, nowadays, if you go see a Hmong healer, you listen, you ask her or him, and the prescribed, they tell you what to do, and you simply do it. It's a one-way street, whereas we're trained to be a partnership. So sometimes you say, well, I want your opinion, and this and this. So I have no opinion about this. I don't know what to do. That's why I'm coming to see you. They want to get treated right away. They don't care about what's going on. They want the symptoms to be cured. And this is important. When I was in Rhode Island, I got a call from Rhode Island Hospital. There was a young lady, a young Hmong woman who went to North Carolina and then came back and had suffered severe abdominal pain and diarrhea, and they cannot find the causes. So she was admitted at Rhode Island Hospital, and for weeks they're trying to find out what's going on. And the mom is a shaman, and so the family is saying, aside from maybe being the patient being the guinea pig, maybe the daughter is going to become a shaman. It's a sign that she is going to become a shaman, so they want it to be a room to get trained. So they provided a room, and the mother came along with another shaman, and they're trying to provide a coaching session to introduce this girl to her, because they thought that the hospital was just not going to treat the symptom. They keep on finding this so-called cause, and they don't know what that is. Quick fixes versus management. Hypertension have caused a lot of problems for Hmong, diabetes, the diet has changed, and many of these things. And so Hmong want a quick fix. They don't. I think these are issue of science where they think it's something that you get something, you fix it right away. And particularly in domestic disputes and divorce and all of that, Hmong is, life for Hmong and relationship for Hmong involve both spiritual and physical. In America, when you end a relationship, a divorce, whether the kid going mom or dad, is about economic issue in terms of support. For Hmong, is beyond that. If my wife and I are divorced, and my kid go with my wife, my kid are still Taos. If something should ever happen to them, the ritual, their funeral, their weddings, all those have to happen according to a Tao process, not her new husband or whatever the other process may be. So it's much, much more complicated, and sometimes Hmong feels very stuck, very unappreciative of, and not sure what to do. One of the issues in our latest community retreat for this program, one of the things many, many of the elders said was one of the complications they think is potential variable for the increased suicide and violence for some of these murder-suicide cases, because when there's an ending to a marriage in America, you never end, because you never end the economic term, but then you wash your hand in terms of the spiritual responsibility, and then how do you resolve that? And so there's a lot of contradiction, a lot of unresolved issues. So they feel very stuck. They feel very desperate how to do this. When a Hmong person die or a deceased, Hmong believe that life, because life and death is cyclical, there is a reincarnation in process, that the body needs to be intact, the concept of full. Any intrusive invasive procedure or any procedure that have metal foreign objects such as metal or plastic in the body needs to be removed for the body not to be interfered in terms of its reincarnation. So there are a lot of stuff there spiritually that are clashing with American way of thinking in terms of economics and all of those stuff. So Hmong believe life and death is cyclical, and the soul is in some way the center that carry all of those stuff. So after all of these different thinkings and continue to do, we came up with many, many different things as a way to try to connect these different variables. We know that for the Hmong radio program, although the information is very critical, only the adults and the elder community listen to it. The teenager does not listen to it. They don't think it's kind of hip thing. So we felt that the teen magazine would be one way that we could really, really get the message to the team, in addition to annual community retreat that are strictly with the adolescents. We know that the radio show has a deep followership from the Hmong community, particularly adult, and it's a bi-monthly show on the second and fourth Tuesday of the month. It's an hour-long radio that includes all kinds of topics, from child protections to relationship between couples, and this month we're trying to get a judge to come in and to share with the Hmong community how does custody get decided? What are some of the issue variables that may be used to decide on a custody issue? What are the variables that a judge of the legal system is looking for? We want to know. So we're going to have that show in the next few weeks or so. We're going to be inviting a gentleman who to talk about rage, the difference between rage and anger. We felt that in order to be inclusive of everyone from the community's view, both the Hmong and non-Hmong as a professional and mom and dad, grandparents and elders, we had the community retreat, which has been a very valuable tool because it provides us with a lot of raw material and perspective from first-person perspective to us. The monthly talking circle is a coalition of agencies, representative individuals in the community, community leaders, and that as a way to continue to kind of look at what can this initiative do with the community. But lately we've been more reflective of what is it about this coalition that needs as a change agent. Do we need more training on the monthly talking circle member? What are the issues? Why are you coming here to this? And then this cross-cultural consultation is a monthly thing. I did it for 2 years. We did not do this year because we don't have any participants. It's a monthly consultation where another clinical psychologist and myself are leading that. People actually come and do case presentation. We kind of provided the cross-cultural perspective of some clinical work for them. And then I've been traveling in the state of Minnesota to different pockets in the inner city as well as out in the suburb where the Hmong continue to move out to, again, to do training about Hmong culture and Hmong way of looking at health and other issues as a way to, again, connect it. So this has been kind of the work that we've been doing with the Suicide and Violence Prevention and Hmong American Partnership. So I'll stop at this point and I'm trying to answer any question that anybody may have.
Thanks, Drew. That was really, really interesting. Does anyone have any questions?
Hi, this is Chris from the Lifeline. I have some questions, actually. Thank you, Drew. That was a really great presentation. One question I have is, I know that, let's see how to put this, that that sometimes Western, you know, whether it's public health folks or whether it's, you know, doctors or people, you know, at any level, kind of have a really big on evaluation and a really big on how do we, you know, how do we tell that this is working? And I know that one of the things and one of the challenges with working with minority populations, specifically immigrants, is you know, how do we measure, or Native Americans, you know, how do we measure shamans, or how do we, you know, how do you say, well, this, you know, this ceremony works and this ceremony, you know, can do this. And I wonder, have you had any successes working with, you know, Western public health folks or with anybody, you know, like that around, you know, evaluation and, you know, immigrant and specifically Hmong populations?
Well, I share with you what I've seen personally as a person in the field is that I know the psychological profiling, too, has been very difficult for me. Difficult because the way Hmong have lived our life, I remember that I had a psychologist who, when I was in private practice, I hired him for supervision on a monthly basis. And then one time, Greg and I did a evaluation of this Hmong woman here showing this picture and say, well, ask her to tell me what happened before this picture and what happened at this picture, what happened in the picture, and what do you think is going to end?
Hmm.
And this woman had no education before. The picture looks like there was an object on the back that looks like a triangle, and when Hmong were collecting, harvesting rice in November, they pile it into a pile like that. And he and she go, well, it looks like somebody's harvesting rice. And Greg goes, true? Is this okay? What are you thinking? And say, it's okay. It's not because she's not normal. It's that's her life experience. Kind of that's all she knows. She's
right.
Not someone who's trained in that. So in my experience, reading psychological evaluation and then seeing that plan, I think the clinical profiling, the tools of is going to be one thing that I think will need a lot more work because it's not just the question, but it's, I think, the language precision concept, although you use from different ways to measure for reliability and all those. I don't think it comes, because when American, when you look at the evaluation, if you ask for memory or short-term memory, long-term memory, and all kinds, you can ask them from different point of view, so then you can later kind of look at whether the reliability of that. For Hmong, if you're depressed, there's only one way of depressed. memory. So the language precision makes it very, very difficult to make it reliable. The other thing that is very hard is that I think what we struggle a lot at Hmong American Partnership and everywhere here is everybody's talking about evidence-based.
Right.
Well, evidence-based, I know that our state is very big on these like MST, the multi-systemic systems, so all these systems. Well, I don't know if it works because I think for me, when I do therapy, it takes me forever to just get them to know what the heck I'm doing in therapy. And when HMO is going to give me 4 sessions to do evaluation, then I have to get more prior authorization. And then by the third session, they want to know what's working, what's not. It is very hard. It's very hard. So I don't have any concise solution, but I don't know. I think what we ultimately, for me, what the deciding factor for me is that if it's not working, then I know that the client's not coming back. I know that one of the things for me is that by 3 or 4 sessions, I will every session like they're not going to be the next session because I don't know if they believe in me, they're going to come back or not. And so I believe that whether if you do shaman, if they go back and again, then whether you and I believe it's working for us or not is irrelevant. If it's the client's feeling like it's working for them, they go back, then it's working. Even though we say it's evidence-based working, if they're not coming back, then I don't know who's getting the benefit of the evidence-based stuff. So I don't know. I think it's a real issue for debate.
I had a question about depression in general. So it was this is Ellen from FPRC.
Okay.
Was there no such thing as depression in the old country? Is that never a concept or a diagnosis? Is that completely new?
No, I think depression is, I think all of the mental health that we've seen in this country exists in Laos. I think what is different is that I think how we culturally define that manifestation is was very different. I think if we see ourselves the way we are more psychological mindedness in this country, so we see depression, we define the manifestation of someone who's going through depression very different from someone who's going through depression in Laos, because I think how we label the manifestation, although the symptoms and signs are very universal. When Hmong who come in to see me is depressed, they have the same symptom that my American client has it, but how they define that manifestation in order to identify that they're not well, and then it dictates whether they get help, now, are very culturally different in a different setting, I believe. So in Laos, until they're physically impaired, when you're worried and you're depressed, you'll tell some elder, say, don't think about that. Just put it away. Step on it, and then it'll go away. I think that defines how they understand the manifestation versus if they go to someone Americans would say, well, you're depressed, so maybe you shouldn't step on, but you should talk about it, you know? So I think what's different about mental illness is that I think we have everything that we see here. What is different is I think the environment and the culture has defined the manifestation very differently, and then that triggers people's sense of health-seeking behavior in a very different way. Does that make sense?
That's very well said.
Mm-hmm.
That explains a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
True.
Yes.
This is Harry Friedman in Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
Who have you left in Rhode Island who is carrying your torch?
You know, I was the only Hmong social worker in town in 95 when I left. I was at John Hope. I worked for Woonsocket for Northern Rhode Island Mental Health Center. Then I worked down in the Trauma Center at Rhode Island Hospital. Then I was the clinical director and the social service director at John Hope. Then I left in 95. So I don't know who is another Hmong social worker in town, but I actually have kind of left, but the Hmong community in Providence has kind of dwindled down to very little.
Mm-hmm.
They all either moved here, moved to Michigan, or moved down to North Carolina.
I have another question.
Mm-hmm.
The Hmong community is tightly knit.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Is the Hmong community tight knit?
Yes.
Okay.
We are one of the 4 Southeast Asian refugees, but Hmong, the hierarchical structure continues to be very intact. One of the things we joke about in Minnesota and everywhere is that I think the U.S. Census are not accurate about the Hmong as much as the Hmong census of the Hmong community. Because in Minnesota, we strongly believe that there are about 80,000 Hmong here, and the census only reflects about 40,000, and we think it's way off. But the community continues to be highly intact because every clan has an organization and every clan has very accurate statistics among. So we continue to be highly knitted community, very highly interwoven in many aspects in terms of health, funeral, you name it.
The reason I ask you is that there is one successful suicide prevention program in place, and
mm-hmm.
that was put in place by the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they depend, there are two key elements to that. One is leadership,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is the buddy system of one person helping another.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems that if you have a very tight-knit community with a strong sense of leadership, that the elements of the Air Force program are probably going to be useful to you.
I think so. I think when I heard a little bit from Lloyd when I was in Pittsburgh, and I met Dr. Littman who did that?
David Litt.
Yeah, I was down, and when Save put the Yellow Ribbon put a workshop down in Mankato, I went down to do a talk, and he was facilitating my session there. I didn't know that he did this. I heard a little bit from Lloyd, and I don't know much about the project, but it sounds very interesting.
Well, ask them to give you the stuff. If you give me your email, I'll send you the stuff as well.
Sure.
The possible applicability in Rhode Island is with the homeless, who are also very tight-knit. Nobody else cares for them except themselves.
Sure.
So there is a prospect that the Air Force model could be applied here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very impressed with your presentation, and I extend you an invitation to eat in my house next time you're in Rhode Island.
Likewise, too. So you do know a lot about Hmong then. Because historically, until we came to America, if I'm a Tao and I go to California, for example, I have no money. If I find another Tao, then they're obligated to care for me. So actually, there's a professor at Brown. Her name is Pat Simon. She has become my dad's oldest daughter. And when my dad passed away in 2001, she is, for the first time in my life, I saw a Caucasian woman came and kill a cow as a way to put closure to my dad. We were so moved. So when you're in Minnesota, do stop by me and have dinner with me.
Absolutely.
True, this is Lloyd Clotter at SPRC.
Okay.
I was struck by a number of, the comments that you made in terms of, I guess you might call it cultural clash, and kind of some of the problems that creates. And I'm curious if you could maybe talk a little bit about efforts to try to address that issue in terms of maybe doing education to Anglo service providers or others. So that's one question. For example, like with police or within schools or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other question has to do with crisis services and hotlines and whether or not that might, how that might be a strategy that is or is not used, and what are some of the barriers or some of the successes with that in terms of the Hmong.
Mm-hmm. As far as the crisis line from the get-go, we have worked hard in Minnesota. They have a very successful agency in town called the Crisis Connection, where they're very well known for their work. Back in 2001, we met with the clinical director there, and along with the Hmong American Partnership's executive director, and we put a proposal in. The problem until nowadays, when the welfare reform went into put in motion, as well as when the wave of murder suicide, there was the Hmong community as well as the provider community was very concerned about copycat effect and how do we get a crisis line in. It continued to be a need, but the problem is no one's willing to fund it. And so it's an issue of staff. At the radio program, I can't tell you how many calls we get each night we go on air, but one of the things we have made a conscious decision is for the host of the radio to become a host and not a response to crisis, because we don't want to open a can of worms. The community is very small. If you start talking about a cave on the ear, whether you identify the people or not, people begin to sense who they are. And so we are very concerned about these, and there's truly a need, but we have explored all kinds of options, but the sustainability from funding as well as from a human professional training is continues to be a dilemma for us. But I think it's something that will definitely benefit a lot, but we just don't have the human and the funding sources to sustain this kind of need. But I think it will be a tremendous help for us. As far as the cultural differences, I think this is the kind of stuff that I think school cannot train us well enough, because I think when we live here, if our way of life, we draw from our life, our sense of personal value and our life experience, we draw from that to make our decision in how we interact and how we assess people. Is that it's very hard. And one thing I often say to people is that when I do diversity training, if the whole time I talk here you don't understand and you don't feel comfortable, then welcome to the world of immigrants and refugees, because every day they don't get what you're talking about and they feel like they're giving in every day because they're tired of that, because they don't feel like anybody is interesting or understand what they're talking about. Because I think that the way we, our basis to how we conceptualize these things are very different, very, very different. You know, one of the example I often say to people is like, a simple example is when I walk in the room here for Americans, if the room is cold, you kind of say, would you guys mind if we turn the thermometer on? It's hot, it's cold in here, you know, and for Hmong, and certainly for many other Asians, we kind of say, ooh, it's kind of cold here, meaning, well, somebody turn the thermometer on, you know. And so unless we have that kind of cultural understanding of stuff that are said and not said, and what are the basis to how they conceptualize their thinking, and be open to that. One of the things we had a discussion, there was a police officer who represents the chief of St. Paul, the talking circle, who kind of talked to Sergeant Nelson, is that what is the mandate of the police? If the police job on a when they call to domestic violence or disturbance is, are they there to separate or are they there to, because for a moment when the guys, when they're responding and someone who goes to jail, even though you define it as a cooling period, someone's going to jail, you know? And so that is a shameful fact already, and how we do that? So that is, people, rather than go to jail, can we find ways to send them to their uncle or to neighbors so it's not going to jail, so it's not a loss of faith? You know, how do we do things that are different from a conceptual framework so that our basis of our thinking are very different from your own way? And so there are a lot of stuff that I think we're just going to need to work at and to understand where people are and how do we do. But most importantly, I want to say that we don't want to do things in a way that would take culture into account so much that we do away with safety. Because I think that one of my strong beliefs, and I know a lot of Hmong colleagues and others may disagree with me, but I don't care how strong culture is. If someone's going to die, then that culture is no good to me. So I want people to be safe, be kicking alive, but at the same time, we have to do way, because beyond the incidents, how do we link that that person back to the community, and so they can have a, can live a meaningful life, you know? As I said before, for example, when Hmong go to a domestic violence dispute and the judge said, you ended this, but you're going to pay child support. Well, we talk about economics. The judge doesn't take into account, okay, what about the spirituality? If then, if the father's obligated all of this, and when the child dies, it goes back to the father, how does, where does the woman come in? There are a lot of stuff that we don't take into account because our life doesn't see those kind of dimensions, you know? And so I think in many ways, those of us who are provided continue need to be open-minded about these and explore these, because we're not going to ever know all about that, including me. When one of the mistakes I made when I went as a graduate student from Hmong, as a Hmong person to work in Woonsocket, which is all French-Canadians, I say many things, do many things, that I got in trouble. But I think the reality is that I need to say this is true. There are many things that I come from this kind of thinking. I will make mistakes as long as I'm honest about, because the evaluation of people will make about me will be in a group and not in one incident. So if I'm honest and I make honest mistakes, that I'm willing to learn it, not in a way that people see me as being degrading to them, you know. So I don't know if that helps you or not, because I don't have any specific thinking about that.
Okay.
Any other things?
Yeah, I wanted to ask about this 18 clan, Ellen from STRC.
Council?
The 18, what is it, a cultural council? Mm-hmm. So you said that model's used in Minnesota?
It's very well used here.
So is that something that's been evaluated or could be replicated in some of these other communities where there's a Hmong population?
I think so. I think for the Hmong, it would definitely be something, because we as a community continue to have a lot of respect for that structure. I think if you look at the different sectors, as I say, Asian-born, Asian race, I would say a large proportion of Hmong continue to believe in the work they do. I think that how we need to kind of help them grow in terms of composition, in terms of genders, education, and different views, so that we take away a lot of the perception that from the women that these are all male-dominated stuff, which in many instances are true, but in many instances, these are people who are willing to give their time sitting for 14 hours on Saturday and Sunday to do different kind of mediation. So I think we need a lot of different work, but I think the structure continues to be a very helpful entity.
And the book, The Spear Catches You and You Fall Down, is that something you would say is fairly accurate? Have you read that?
You know, everybody talked to me about Ian Fetterman's book. I have not read it, but it's such a... I think she's making good money on that book, so I don't know. I just have not had the time to read that book.
All right, well, you know, from what you were saying about the traditional remedies and all those are all incorporated in her book.
I know that she was recently in Minnesota to do a talk at the school. I just didn't have the time to go, but she's very popular.
I guess, true, this is Patrice from SBRC.
Okay.
I was interested in that whole concept about being in limbo, like being disconnected from both cultures. And I'm just wondering whether for the new, really for the first generation, for actually people like your kids who are born here, but have a very strong cultural ties from their family, will they be more at risk? I mean, to me, it just seems to me that it is really that group is even going to get, have maybe be even more at risk because the disconnect will be even more strongly felt to them.
You know, I should have sent you a slide. There was another slide that I have that I often use for training on that spot, is that I think the word limbo can have multiple way of looking. And one way, when you look at for the adolescent, life for them is about acculturating, enculturating back to understand their identity as a Hmong person. And they are American, like my son John, who's 21, is truly an American. The only thing he's different from Nicholas on the other side of the street here is that he's Asian, physical in nature. But John's thinking and acting just like any other American adolescent. So I think in some way John's struggle is that he'll never be accepted as American because he's Hmong. And people ask where John comes from. John's like, I come from Minnesota. I'm born here. I'm born in Rhode Island. So why do you keep on asking me that? So I think his sense of struggle will continue to be enculturating to understanding his Hmong so he can have a complete identity of being Hmong, living in America. But what is it? Why do Hmong do these things and why these things? Whereas for my mom, my dad, I think their sense of limbo is they're not sure what the rule of the game is. Many of the things they do nowadays, well, when we get into arguments, my mom will come in and say to my wife, well, stop doing that because women do this. And my wife said, we're not like you anymore, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I think my mom, my dad's sense of limbo and their sense of struggle is to acculturate to American life and to have their full identity of have their life as based or formed based on the values and the things that they felt was important as a Hmong person. And many of the values and practices are being questioned. So I think when you look at limbo, Hmong, that's why I think community, refugee community are very vulnerable because there isn't a way to benchmark what is the value, whose value and which value and how do we do which is healthy, which is not healthy. So for us, we know that was going to be a complicated part. So rather than say these are answers, we say we want to get a dialogue. We want to get people to talk and maybe trust the process because sometimes the process of talking will probably be very meaningful to a lot of people. And we chose the radio because we want to have throw a lot of idea out there so that people can synthesize that and wherever their sense of growth and development, they can certainly use it based on they want and not use it as either an answer, you know, because I think exactly to your point that the word limbo is defined very differently to very different groups in the community.
Is there anyone else has any questions?
True. Another time you spoke about talking with people in the laundromat and the funeral home.
Yes.
Can you tell a little bit about that?
Yes. Let me give you a very, very concise example. You know family planning. Are you the one from Minnesota or Wisconsin?
Yeah.
Okay. You know that family planning has been a struggle for the Hmong community. We had this woman who's a licensed practical nurse. She worked for this clinic in town. They had a program for family planning. When people go to the clinic and she approached them about condoms, nobody wants to talk about that. But when she's at the funeral home, everybody goes sit with her and guess what they talk about? Condoms. So we call her condom lady. Because when we work with Hmong, those of you who are in supervisory position, I don't know if other ethnic community is true, but for the Hmong, it's very tricky. those of us who live in the community have an identity, and when we go to an agency, we carry the identity there and cross back and forth, whether we accept it or not. So there is a certain obligation that the agency needs to be conscientious about this in terms of protecting your staff, if they get high burnout, they get threats for unnecessary stuff, and so there's a double-edged sword for them. So she's very effective with her family planning. We're not at the clinic, and these people don't think she's effective there, but she's so effective, people go to a funeral home and say to her husband, Mr. Yang, can I sit with your wife? I said, what are you going to talk about? We're going to talk with her about condoms. We didn't want to do that at the clinic because it seems too obvious. So we're going to talk about your chatting here. And so in many ways, we know that the way to be effective with Moa, we have to find their natural location where they conduct their business and make the process as natural as possible. Otherwise, it becomes too foreign for them. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the dissemination, we know that the radio was a means for us to take away the shame, but also at the same time to begin to kind of acknowledge that there are a lot of issues here and we don't have the answer, but let's talk about these things. And what we encourage you to do is to maybe have a talk with your wife. You know, one of the things, for example, we know that back in Laos, chores are divided quite clearly because of our circumstance, life circumstance, but nowadays women have a job. Women are professionally trained, they're highly educated, they have the same economic potential, the same intelligence. So that's going to change our sense of dynamic with the husband and wife, and how does the community relate with the wife and the husband. And so there are many changes, but I don't know if people have permission to talk about these things. So the radio was a way out to engage these discussions in a public sense, and yet not make it shameful for anybody. So. Because these are some of the thinking we put into as a way to kind of engage the community, talk about these different things.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your slide on differences between refugee and immigrant is excellent and very applicable for just about every immigrant group in Rhode Island.
I know when I was there, I did a workshop, I did a psychologist, Dr. Vargas, and I did a training on that, because I think that a lot of times, we tend to label people because they're not in the same kind of thinking and acting the way we are. We miss that they're resistant, they're all that. But it is because they are acting and thinking and living the way they do about 5 months ago, 10 months ago, 20 months ago. You know, and so the stuff in Minnesota, we're very cold here. And people often ask me, say, sure, you know, I just feel kind of sad to see these small people walking on University Avenue with this thin blouse and sandal. I say, well, if you're asking if they're okay, they're okay. These are refugees who come and these are nice, clean clothes, you know? They're not thinking that it's going to be 20 below. I had a woman who had this belief that child protection referred the kids because she believed that her son is the chosen one because when the Hmong refugees who live in the camp had this really weird, almost cult-like religious belief that certain people are chosen in spirit, are kind of walking around everywhere around you. And so she allowed her kids to dress in a certain way, and being low socioeconomic, they live in this very poor, insulated house where the kids are constantly sick and the child protection is constantly on her case. And she came in, I said to her, Auntie, why do you dress this kid like this in Minnesota? Don't you know it's very cold here? The kid gets sick all the time, you get in trouble all the time, you know, don't you want to get off this stuff? And she said, yeah, she said, I do, but this is a chosen one, you know, and you can't do this stuff. And I say, what are the ways that we can do that is still not offending this and this? So I think we need to understand their own thinking as a way so that we can kind of in some way be effective in their own worldview. Otherwise, everything we do and say is too foreign to them.
Well, thank you again. It's an excellent presentation, and I'm signing off. I have to go.
All right.
The invitation still applies.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Anyone else?
Well, True, thank you. Thank you so much, True. I think that was fantastic. That was, to me, a very humanizing discussion. It was great. So I really want to thank you for that, and I think everybody feels pretty much the same.
Thanks for your help, Patrice. You were good in Pittsburgh with me, and you're good here, so thank you.
And I'll send you the Air Force program, the info on that. I'll send that to you.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you very much. Bye, Chris, and nice vacation.
Bye-bye.